The Berlin Philharmonic with the Symphony No. 36 by Mozart, his Linz Symphony. They don't name a conductor, but this is from a recording they made as an AIDS benefit.
You are listening to WHFR Dearborn, broadcasting out of Henry Ford Community College. Thank you for tuning in on this day. We would love to share the opportunity of underwriting or sponsorship with you. If you have a business or organization that you think might benefit by partnering with WHFR, your non-commercial radio station here in the community, well, I'd love to talk with you. I'm Susan McGraw, WHFR General Manager, and here's my telephone number. Let's chat. 313-845-9842. Again, 313 845-9842. Underwriting or sponsorship of WHFR's airwaves is really a cost-effective way to get your business name or organization name out to our very loyal and very wonderful listeners. It's a win-win situation. We can certainly use the funds that are generated through underwriting to help us continue the mission of making waves here in Metro Detroit, and you will partner and benefit through your great loyalty from our listeners. So hope to hear from you.
Antonín Dvořák was remarkably well-adjusted. Other 19th-century composers fit into the tortured artist mold, but not him. He went through some very difficult periods in his life, but by all accounts, he was just a happy, good-natured person all the way through. I am Gillian Martin. Maybe you need some of that even-tempered good cheer as we get closer to Christmas. Well, Maurice Janssens and the Oslo Philharmonic will hand-deliver it in just a few minutes when they play Dvorak's Scherzo Capriccioso.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. We're bringing you non-commercial radio from Henry Ford Community College.
Hi, I'm Anderson Coleman, host with Blues with the Feeling on Saturdays, WHFR.FM. I'm here to say happy holidays and Merry Christmas. Drive safely.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotel.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, we'll talk with George Whitmore, one of the climbers who was part of the first ascent of Yosemite's El Capitan 50 years ago this month. We'll also talk with Catherine Miskowski from Salon.com about new trends in rising public transit ridership. Finally, we'll talk with author R.J. Repenthal about his book, Fresh Food from Small Spaces, The Square Inch Gardener's Guide to Year-Round Growing, Fermenting, and Sprouting. This month marks the 50th anniversary of the first ascent of the vertical face of Yosemite's El Capitan, the majestic 3,000-foot granite rock that is one of California's most famous natural landmarks and one of the world's favorite challenges for rock climbers. Joining us today is George Whitmore, who was part of the team that first climbed El Capitan 50 years ago this month. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
It's great to have you on the show. Let's talk about how you first got interested in climbing. 50 years ago, rock climbing was not the widespread sport that it is today. How did you get your start?
Yes, it was relatively little known back then. In the late 1930s, when I would have been about 7 or 8 years old, I remember seeing people down on the bridge at the foot of Lower Yosemite Falls pointing up to rock climbers on the walls way up high. I was about 7 or 8 at the time, so I was exposed to it early on. And then at a car camping trip to Pinnacles National Monument, I observed an uproarious campfire, bonfire party going on, and I said, who in the world are those people? And, oh, they're the rock climbers. And then I moved into a house in San Francisco where two climbers lived. So then I started learning all about it and how to get involved.
Now, how did you get the idea to climb El Capitan, and how did people react to that back in the day?
Well, actually, I was away in the Air Force at the time the climb was started. The climb actually took 47 days, spread over a 16-month period, and it was started in July of 1957. I was gone at the time, and when I came back in September, I found that this momentous project had been started. And Warren Harding was the one who got the idea of climbing it, and it was largely in reaction to his having been left out of the first ascent party on the face of Half Dome. That story has been told many times, how he was very upset, distraught over having been left out of that climb, and so he was in search of something bigger and better, and it was sort of obvious what it would have to be.
Now, for some of our listeners who haven't been to Yosemite and might not be familiar with El Capitan, can you just describe for us what it looks like, what the physical challenges of climbing such a steep vertical face?
Well, it dominates your view as you arrive in Yosemite Valley. There's only one way into Yosemite Valley from the west, and regardless of which highway you take, they all converge and come in from the west. And as you enter the valley, on your left, the view is dominated by this massive granite face. And even when you're in the valley, as you go on up the valley to the east, there's nothing as large as that or as sheer as that. So it has quite an impact on people as they enter the valley. And the so it's well known, I think, worldwide as being the largest granite monolith. That is, there are granite walls elsewhere in the world that are higher than that, but they're part of an overall mountain massif, whereas El Capitan is freestanding. And so they refer to it as the largest granite monolith.
What did it feel like as you're swinging there on those ropes, literally thousands of feet off of the ground?
Well, it's different when you start at the bottom and go up gradually. A lot of people wonder about that. And even people who do a lot of climbing, if they don't start at the bottom, if instead they go around up to the top and then they go over the edge 3,000 feet above the ground, they feel very queasy about it. And there's something about going at the bottom and starting up. You keep your perspective. You just gradually see the ground recede away from you, and somehow you adjust to it. Whereas if you are just, it's like looking over the edge of a building. That is a very uneasy feeling for most people. But if you started up the side of the building, it wouldn't be the same.
Well, how did you feel that day that you reached the top, that you were part of that first team to climb the vertical face of El Capitan?
Well, probably a lot of people figure there must have been a wild party on top or something, but there was not. There was just a great sense of satisfaction that the long effort had finally succeeded. In fact, there was talk, oh, El Capitan has been conquered, and Warren, there's the famous quote from Warren Harding, where he said, "I noticed that El Capitan was in considerably better condition than I was." So it was, you might say, a subdued celebration.
How has climbing changed in the past 50 years? What kind of equipment do people use now that wasn't available back then?
Well, there have been major changes, not only in the equipment, but also the standards. At that time, there's a rating system that climbers use for free climbing, meaning when you're not dangling from your hardware, but rather you're hanging onto the rock in one way or another, with using the hardware only for protection in case you fall. But the free climbing rating system at that time, well, let me back up. The free climbing rating system now goes from 5.0 to, I believe it's 5.14, and never mind the mathematical illogic of that. There was a barrier when people got to 5.9. They thought, well, you can't call it 5.10. That's mathematically illogical. But they finally got over that and just went ahead and called it 5.10, 5.11, and so on. But at that time, 5.9 was considered to be the limit of what was humanly possible. Well, over the years, that limit of what is humanly possible has kept increasing. Just like the 4-minute mile barrier, people not only broke the barrier, but they kept on lowering it. And so 5.9 was considered what the ultimate at that time, and now they're up to, I believe it's 5.14, and who knows how long it'll be before they get to 5.15. So there's a huge increase in standards as far as what is considered humanly possible. As far as equipment, for us, climbing fixed ropes many, many times over and over and over again, using Prusik knots, which is a loop of rope that you fasten around the line that goes up the wall. Then you slide the knot up, and then it holds your weight when you put weight on it. That was very time-consuming, whereas not too long after that climb, the use of mechanical ascenders reached California. I suspect they were used in Europe before that, but they didn't show up here in California until after we had done that climb. So that would have made a huge difference. It would have saved a lot of time if we had had mechanical ascenders. And then also the a lot of problem we had was with extra wide cracks that were too wide to accept any pitons that were available at the time. And so we made special pitons to work with those cracks. The pitons were very crude, but at least they worked. They got us up. But since then, various devices have been made which deal with that problem much more effectively. And in particular, there's camming devices. They're little mechanical things that spread apart as you put weight on a small aircraft cable.
And one question here. What about food? What do you eat to keep you going while you're spending 5, 6, 7 days?
Well, the main problem is liquid. You don't eat much. However, you do need liquid, and so there's no particular reason to use dehydrated food. Everyone asks about that. Oh, do you eat dehydrated food? Well, no, there's no point in it because we would have to carry the water to hydrate it. So at that time, we ate a lot of canned soups, just eat the canned soup out of the can with a spoon, and an extremely poor diet from a nutritional point of view, but it worked. Whatever was convenient, and it worked.
Are you still climbing today?
I like to do easy stuff. I abandoned the technical climbing a long time ago, but I still like to do easy climbs on that, preferably with something that gets to the top of a mountain, but hard enough that it's advisable to carry a rope, but hopefully not so hard that you need to use the rope.
Any words of inspiration or advice to our listeners who are just starting learning how to climb now?
I think that people need to keep in mind that there are still and probably will always be opportunities to explore the so-called impossible, to keep pushing the envelope. In our time, that was managing to get up the face of El Capitan by any means we could figure out. But since that has been done, other people have put up many more additional routes on the face of the cliff, and some of my friends are now seeing how fast they can do a known route, like what took us 47 days. The second ascent took 6.5 days, and recently that has been brought down to 2 hours and 37 minutes, I believe it is. So some people push the envelope that way, seeing how fast they can do it. Other people see how many different routes they can do. I have a friend who's done 25 or so different routes, and she's pushing, wanting to get more and more different routes. There are various ways that people can explore the impossible. And I always think of the quote that at the end of the book, Annapurna, which was by Maurice Herzog regarding the first ascent of an 8,000-meter peak in the Himalaya. And the last sentence in that book was, "There are other Annapurnas in the lives of men." And there are other ways for people to meet these challenges, to deal with them, perhaps to succeed in overcoming the challenge. Just because the face of El Capitan has been climbed doesn't mean there aren't challenges remaining. I think there will always be challenges.
Well, thanks so much. It's been great having you on the show today. You've been listening to George Whitmore, who was part of the team that first climbed El Capitan 50 years ago this month. Catherine Miskowski, the senior environmental correspondent from Salon.com, joins us to talk about her recent article entitled, "Who Says Americans Won't Ride Mass Transit?" Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Mass transit. Great topic. And everyone's been thinking about this lately because gas prices are so high. So with the gas prices being so high, public transit ridership is going up. And you write in this article, though, that the news isn't all that sunny. So what's going on here?
Well, on the plus side, it's true that ridership is going up. And in fact, it's at a 50-year high, which really means that since the car took over the country, more people are now taking more trips on public transit, than since that happened. So that is a big deal. However, transit systems across the country are having a really hard time accommodating all these new riders because, as everyone knows, we're in a recession, and so budgets are really tight. So, for instance, on the train that I take to work every day, the Bay Area Rapid Transit, which we call BART, instead of adding new cars or adding more trains, since they're experiencing record ridership, they're taking seats out of the cars so there'll be more room for people to stand, and adding those little hangers that hang down so people will have something to hang on to. So you have this situation where people are flocking to public transit because gas prices have been so high, yet the systems are really facing a crunch because of it.
And what does this mean for the long term? Do you think people are going to be, you know, disenchanted and they're going to not want to ride public transit because it's such a crammed car, you know, they're having a hard time even getting onto the train?
Well, that's the really important question, because what we've seen historically is that ridership really responds to the price of gas. I mean, the only times in recent decades that we've seen this kind of ridership have been, you know, during the oil shocks in the late 70s. And so you have to wonder, you know, if people have a bad experience when they get on public transit, when gas prices are high, when those prices start falling, as they have been recently, will they get back behind the wheel of their car? I mean, of course, what we want is for them to have a great experience on public transit and to think, gee, you know, why have I been slogging on the highway all this time when I could be, you know, reading a magazine or reading my email on the train? But that's really the big open question, I think.
Well, let's talk about funding. I think this is a really interesting issue. We obviously have transportation bills that fund these systems, but so much of that money goes directly to highway infrastructure and not to public transit. What is it looking like today? Do we think that the situation with gas prices will change that funding? Tell us more about that.
Well, you would think that it would, right? I mean, and one indication that's good is on November 4th, voters voted for a lot of new funding for transit. So even though we're in a recession, you know, even though times are tight, the Wall Street Journal reported that 70% of these major transit bills around the country passed. And so that's a really encouraging sign that people want more transit. I mean, some of the projects that got voted in is a bond to develop high-speed rail in California between Northern and Southern California. Seattle voted in a huge bond to increase transit there. And so voters are saying, yes, we want this. However, as you know, when state budgets get really tight, one of the things that gets, penciled out often is transit. And California is a really great example of this. We had this huge fight over our most recent budget, and we cut $1.7 billion from transit in that new budget. And that's especially ironic here in California, because we have these really ambitious goals for how we're going to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, like we're supposed to reduce them to 1990 levels by 2020. And transportation is the largest category of greenhouse gas emissions in California. So there's no way we're going to reach those goals unless we can get people out of their cars and onto transit or walking or other forms of transportation. Yet, while we're setting these goals, we're simultaneously cutting transit. So I think that, the fact that voters are voting in these initiatives during hard times is really great, but their legislatures also need to hear from them that, you know, that they want great transit service, even though it's a difficult time.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but those initiatives, a lot of them are for new transit projects like the high-speed rail. What about money to actually improve the infrastructure that we already have, to add more cars, to add more subway cars to BART or things like that?
That's a really important point, because the money for maintenance and for just adding more cars, that's kind of an unsexy thing, and that tends to come in the state budgets or in the regional budgets, and that doesn't tend to be on the ballot. The ballot initiatives are almost always to expand service, like, you know, try to take BART from San Francisco to Santa Clara, or, you know, those kind of initiatives that would expand new projects. And those are often politically popular, because politicians in those regions will want transit to come to them because it can increase, you know, local revenues and, you know, improve housing and so on in their region. And so those often end up on bills, and that's what people are voting on. But it's really your elected representatives who are deciding, you know, whether or not you're going to get better bus service or not.
And what percentage of Americans ride public transit these days? And how does that compare to people, say, 5, 10, 20 years ago?
You know, it's really fascinating, because while we're seeing this increase in the number of rides that Americans are taking, it's really important to keep this in perspective. So in 1960, about 12% of American commuters got to work on public transit, which really doesn't sound like that much until you hear that by 2000, that number was down to 4.7%. So it was really low.
Wow.
And then it's since then gone up, but it's only gone up to like 4.9%. So it is going in the right direction. But I mean, you can see that we obviously have a, you know, tremendous way to go. And one thing I found really interesting researching this historically is that the most popular time to ride on transit in like the 30s used to be the weekend. Just like when you go on your freeway now, the most crowded time of the week on the freeway is the weekend. But now transit is really mostly used by people commuting to work, and the weekend trips are not as popular.
Now, what happens if gas prices continue to go back down?
I think it's highly likely that you'll see some of those people leaving transit and going back to their car. And so, you know, one question is, you know, whether or not we should have some, if we really want to encourage transit ridership, should we have some kind of gasoline tax? I mean, because it's obviously that people do respond to the price. Now, that might be very politically unpopular, and so it might not actually get off the ground. But you can see a dramatic illustration in the recent spike of high gas prices, how it does turn people to the bus and train.
Well, it just seems like a tremendous opportunity for us, because if people make that leap from their car to public transit and they have a good transit experience, they're not super squished onto a train, then I think there's so many other benefits besides saving money. You can read during your commute, you can work during your commute, you can even sleep during your commute. So what are some of the ways that we could ensure that people have a better experience, we can keep those riders on public transit? Is it just about more funding?
I have to say, I do think funding is the key, because, you know, having the trains be in good condition or the buses be in good condition, not having to wait, you know, not being squished in. These are the highest priorities for transit riders. And I often think of this on my own trip on BART, because there are signs everywhere on BART thanking me for riding BART. And there are even some that say, you know, thanks for not contributing to global warming. And, you know, I do feel good about that, but I would feel a lot better if I could, you know, sit down and read my novel instead of like lurch around trying not to fall down when I'm standing up on the train.
Anything else you want to add for our listeners?
Well, just that I think that this is going to be a really interesting trend to continue to follow. And we'll see if, you know, in 6 months when the new numbers come out about this quarter, if people have stayed with transit or if they've retreated back behind the wheel of their car.
Thanks so much for joining us. You've been listening to Catherine Miskowski, the senior environmental correspondent from Salon.com, talking about her recent article entitled "Who Says Americans Won't Ride Mass Transit?" We've talked before on the show about green gardening, and today we're going to do something a little different. How can you grow fresh organic foods if you live in a city apartment and don't have a large garden? Author R.J. Ruppenthal joins us to talk about his new book, Fresh Food from Small Spaces, The Square Inch Gardener's Guide to Year-Round Growing, Fermenting, and Sprouting. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I think this is a great idea for a book, since I live in an apartment and I love gardening and don't have my own garden. How did you get the idea to write a book like this? Are you an avid gardener?
Well, I've sort of become one, and I had actually grown up spending some time on an organic farm, and so I guess I learned the basics at an early age, but it was for most of my life since then, I have lived in urban areas and smaller spaces, apartments, condos, etc., and somewhere along the line, I got the idea I wanted to grow some plants and try some vegetables, and I didn't have any more at the time than a sunny window, and so I started with a couple of vegetable plants, and I did what I could. And then the next place we lived, we had a bit of a balcony, and we got some containers, filled them with good soil, and started to grow tomatoes, chard, squash, really anything that we could just on our balcony. Pretty soon, we filled up that space, and I started to think, you know, I really enjoy this because I'm a teacher and I'm a licensed attorney, and I don't get the opportunity to really work with my hands, and I like it. So it's something nice to come home at the end of the day and be able to do something that feels so real. So over time, I started thinking, what else could I do in this small space? And even in the shady spots indoors, I realized that I could grow sprouts. I could grow mushrooms, and that there were a lot of possibilities for other people. But since I hadn't seen a book like this, I decided over time I would write one.
Well, I'm glad you did. Let's start by talking about window boxes, because you do say it's the square inch gardener's guide, and everybody has a window that they can use. So I'm curious what kinds of things you think are best to grow in a window box, some easy things people can start out with.
Well, as you probably know, one of the major, probably the major restriction in smaller space gardening situations, and that includes really any urban home pretty much, is a lack of light. And so it may be sunny for a couple hours a day, but it may not be the, you know, 6 to 8 hours that most gardening books recommend. Well, you can actually be successful with a lot less than that. It does depend partly on what you want to grow and, you know, when you're growing it, how much heat you have as well. But some vegetables can certainly do very well with low light situations. You know, if I were starting out, I would recommend to someone starting out that they perhaps look into just salad greens, because that's the easiest way to start out, and it's something that we all eat. It's nutritious, it's delicious,
and will lettuce grow indoors?
Lettuce will grow indoors, yes, and it doesn't need a whole lot of light. So lettuce, arugula, chard, spinach, any of those greens, because they don't need a whole lot of light to just produce the leaves that we eat. Now, if you want to try to grow something like tomatoes or a cucumber or squash, first of all, you want to make sure that you have enough space. But also, those plants do require more light to create the fruit. So another thing, though, that does work well in limited space is, believe it or not, beans and peas. Rather than getting the big, tall pole-growing varieties that need to be trellised, you can get the bush beans or bush peas these days, and they only top out at about 2 or 3 feet, and they produce a crop a lot sooner. It's not quite as big, but you can get some green snap beans or some sugar snap peas in a pretty short period of time.
Now, is that for a balcony, or you could grow them inside?
You could grow them inside as well, because they don't really need trellising. They're just sort of dwarf varieties, and I've grown them with very little light before. Indoors.
That's interesting. We once tried growing tomatoes inside. We got these huge plants. They grew really tall, and they didn't ever grow any tomatoes. We got lots of little flowers, and I think that not enough light and heat really to produce them inside.
Yeah, and the other issue there might be the pollination of the flowers. Having some bees or just really anything with wings to fly by and exchange some of the pollen, some of those plants require it, but others don't.
Now, you also mentioned something in your book called vertical gardening. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, that's one of those strategies that you might use to maximize your use of space. And so if you just have maybe a balcony or a doorstep or a window that provides you some growing space for vegetables or whatever you have in mind, vertical growing is the idea that even if you don't have a lot of horizontal space, maybe you have a few more feet vertically that you could trellis some vines, whether it's something like cucumbers or squash or beans or peas. You could trellis them upward. You could trellis them downward. You can use the railing of a balcony sometimes as a trellis or whatever you have available. And also there are other possibilities like hanging pots and growing bags that you could use for strawberries and for some types of cherry tomatoes, for instance.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to author R.J. Ruppenthal talking about his new book, Fresh Food from Small Spaces, The Square Inch Gardener's Guide to Year-Round Growing, Fermenting, and Sprouting.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit Sierra Club Radio.
Hi, this is Gomike Holloway, wishing all of our loyal listeners a joyous holiday season.
Hi, I'm Bill Keith. On Light from the Underground, I turn the spotlight on songwriters. I'll give you music that crosses genres so that you can hear the widest variety of music. Each week, I look forward to digging through all the new music we've received to find the best new music for you. Some of the artists you'll hear include Peter Case, Soul Live, Over the Rhine, The Bad Plus, and Betty LaVette. But it doesn't stop there. You'll also hear new music from artists making a go of it right here in Michigan. Check out Light from the Underground, Saturdays at 11 a.m. on 89.3 WHFR.FM. We're making waves.
And now a weather update. Winds out of the south-southeast at 9 miles an hour.
Citizens of America, this is a message from feedthepig.org. Do not be alarmed. We are here to help you save yourself. According to public records, Americans spent more money than they earned in 2005. This is the first negative savings rate in the U.S. since the Great Depression. America, we must change our behavior. We need to stop spending every dime we earn and start feeding the pig. We must start putting away a piece of our paycheck. On the 1st and the 15th, we must pay ourselves before we pay anyone or anything. We must make a budget. And yes, even consider cutting up a credit card. And we must tell a friend to do the same. America, to start moving in the right direction, we must start a movement. Join us at feedthepig.org. Find the benefits of saving for every stage of life. Log on to feedthepig.org today.
And for more traffic updates, brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
Do you find it difficult to find the time to work out? Does the price of a gym membership seem too expensive? Don't let these reasons get in the way of exercising. Try the Henry Ford Community College Fitness Center. The HFCC Fitness Center is conveniently located on campus in the Athletic Memorial Building. Drop in between classes or before you go home for the day. You'll save valuable time because you won't have to commute to a gym. And the best part is that use of the fitness center is free to HFCC students. Students should bring their student ID for access. Lockers are available for no charge, but you must provide your own lock. Come and work out at the HFCC Fitness Center.
Listen, was that you?
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. We're thrilled to have legendary singer-songwriter Joan Baez join us today to talk about 50 years of music and activism. We'll also hear from Lisa Ling, special correspondent for CNN, about the stories she reports on for their Planet in Peril show coming up this week. And Dr. Alan Green will tell us about his pledge where he ate only 100% organic food for 3 whole years. Coming up on Sierra Club Radio. We are honored to have folk icon and Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award winner Joan Baez on our show today. 2008 marks 50 years since she launched her musical career, and she is a musical force of nature who has also been a courageous progressive activist, marching on the front lines of the civil rights movement with Dr. Martin Luther King, standing up with labor activist Cesar Chavez. She has just released her 24th studio album, Day After Tomorrow, and we're thrilled to have her on our show. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's really great to have you on the show today. So many of your songs deal with social and progressive issues. Tell us about the intersection of music and activism in your life.
I think it probably started with my family became Quaker, my parents, when I was about 8. So I was always exposed to discussions about violence and nonviolence, and I guess I found them interesting at a very early age. And eventually my social activities, stemmed from the foundation of nonviolence, and it interested me very much, and so I lived my life with it.
Now, in the 60s, music really flourished as a source of social commentary about issues like nonviolence. But where do you think we are today?
Well, we just made such a huge difference in the political atmosphere and everything else that I don't know whether we've all quite landed yet. I know that beautiful songs have been written all during this period, all the last 20 years, but they didn't have much of a platform. And I would say now that these extraordinary songs are being written and that what we're missing is simply an anthem, like a We Shall Overcome or an Imagine, in order for people to really feel it within themselves because they have to be able to sing it.
If you could write a song about the past 8 years, what do you think the title would be?
Oh, dear. Maybe that's the title. Oh, dear.
One of the issues, obviously, that Sierra Club is working very hard on has to do with stopping global warming. And I'm curious to see if that's an issue that, you know, has become very important to you, if you've taken on more environmental issues, both in terms of the issues that you want to write about and also the activism issues that you're so passionate about.
I think global warming may be the most important issue that we have, because we can go battling who's going to be president and prime minister and vice president, but if we don't have an earth that's livable to do that in, then we simply won't be able to do it.
Looking back historically, I mean, you've been on the front lines with your guitar in so many of these incredible moments, marching with Dr. King and working with Cesar Chavez. I would just love to hear about some of the most inspiring and powerful moments that you have that you could share with our listeners, things that can really help people keep going.
I think it's usually courage, because courage is as contagious as violence is. I mean, look at the way we live our lives and the way we conduct ourselves internationally, and it's mostly violent. So when somebody comes along with the real courage to, oh, anything, the mothers of the disappeared in Argentina walking, you know, every evening in honor of their children who've disappeared, you know, knowing anything could happen to them. I think whenever people are in a country that were simply dangerous to do whatever you do, that's, you know, that's not in line with the government, those situations are really incredibly courageous. And for me, I feed off that courage.
What was it like in the height of the movement actually working with Dr. King?
Well, I just loved Dr. King, and I still do. And I, the things that I remember are the more private moments when he was being silly or funny. He had a marvelous sense of humor and enormous courage. I know there were things that he was afraid of. He was apparently afraid of tear gas. And, you know, you just have to go on anyway in spite of whatever fears you have. And he would make his decision by listening the way Gandhi did to the still, small voice within. And for him, it came through prayer. So when he had to make a decision, he'd go and he'd pray until he got the decision. And so my being around him gave me access to all of those thoughts and ideas, plus his wonderful sense of humor.
It's interesting to hear about his sense of humor, because so many of us think of him as this iconic figure who, you know, is larger than life and had such a serious mission. What other experiences have you had where humor has really helped you to get through some of these darker times?
Well, let's see. Let me take something. And when I was working on behalf of the boat people and the Laotians, who weren't being heard from very much, and they too were being dislodged by corrupt governments. And I remember one time being in Thailand, and Thailand was just a short distance from Laos, and the Laotians literally swam that distance and dragged themselves up on the shore in Thailand. And the I think he was a military commander, said he was going to send them all back. And so I went and I said, you know, you can't do that. And he kind of looked at me, and I said, I tell you what, I'll sing you a song. Will that work? So I sang him, I don't know, Swing Low or something. And the humor of it is that it was so astoundingly simple. And he said, okay, they can stay.
Well, let's talk a little bit about music. Tell us about some of the songs and the themes on your new album. What are you most excited about? What has really been the most successful part of this experience for you with this 24th studio album?
I think the important thing turned out to be, we kind of suspected it, but it turned out to be that it was unplugged and reminiscent of the early years, ballads and stories, and the fact that we didn't use electronic stuff. And it was a combination of Steve Earle and myself that worked very well. And what I guess we ended up thinking was that this should be a bookend to the very beginning. And I think that's kind of how it turned out to be.
You've had so many hit songs over the year. You might get this question a lot, but I'm very curious about if you have a personal favorite or two.
Well, you know, like everybody, when you're walking around, you start humming a song. That could be your favorite during that day. So I really, the only way I can answer that is that it fluctuates from one song to another, and one might be perfectly obscure, and I rediscover it, and you know, I'm in love with it all over. So I can't answer that very well.
What keeps performing fresh for you after 50 years of live performances in front of audiences? What's still exciting for you?
Well, what's exciting is what I didn't used to have for excitement, mainly because I was so full of stage fright and responsibilities, and you know, I handled them, but it kept me from having much fun on the stage. And now, because most of what I'm doing at home right now is being with my family. My mother's 95, and I have a son and I have a grandchild, 5 years old. So I take that very seriously and, you know, spend a lot of time with that, and it alters everything else that I do. It subdues a lot of things, and it also encourages a lot of things.
You know, it's interesting to hear that you have stage fright, because you wouldn't think that someone who experiences that would choose performing as a profession. How did you get over that as you entered the musical and the activist world, which also has a real responsibility for being in the public eye?
Well, for years, I guess the drive to just sing was greater than the fear, because the fear was terrible. And then getting over it, part of it was no experience walking on the stage, but I must tell you that the greater part of it took place in the last 20 years when I went inside of me to do the kind of therapy that one needs to really, really change, not just to patch things together to keep going, but really go in there and tooth and nail, grapple with the things that had been the root of the problems, and, you know, the root of the stage fright. And now, you know, it's 20 years later, but starting about 17 years ago, I dropped the stage fright. I mean, it's extraordinary doing some internal work and then come out of it, and the next day something changes for the better.
So what advice would you give young people who are out there today who are inspired by your work, both as a singer and also as an activist? Where can they draw inspiration? What can help them keep going when things are tough?
Well, I think they have to get with other people who also are interested in the playing and the music. And I think that it probably would be helpful to just go to whatever local place is an open mic and just start exposing yourself to whatever you'll feel like and whatever you can have to offer to other people, because there'll be a good measure of what's felt from your music.
You've been in the singer-songwriter world for 50 years, and you've been involved in these causes for just as long, if not longer. How do you think perspectives on environmental issues have changed over the years, both in terms of what you see in the music community, and then you travel so extensively and see so many different audiences? How are people relating differently to the environment?
Well, I would hope that they will sooner rather than later adapt to the severity of what's going on. And I know that people already react differently. It's just that not enough of us do what we really need to do, the birds, the bees, the animals, the polar bears. And the forces against that are great as well. I mean, the Sarah Palins of the world are not alone.
And would you like to add anything about your tour, your upcoming album, just so folks?
Yeah, the tour, I think we take 4 or 5 songs from the album, but then it's a question of traversing 50 years and trying to, you know, choose the things that I still love and present them to the audience in a way that really takes people on a wonderful ride through the evening.
And how do you choose out of all of those songs? What are the ones that are still resonating with you 50 years into your career?
Well, sometimes something new will pop up, and that's again these musicians, because they've listened to it all and they suggested, for instance, the other day singing Catch the Wind by Donovan. I hadn't thought of that song for over 20 years, but it was wonderful when we put it together. You know, I mean, that would be a surprise to me.
Well, Joan, thank you so much for joining us. You've really been an inspiration to so many of us, and thank you for being on our show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
You've been listening to legendary singer, songwriter, and activist Joan Baez, who has just released her 24th studio album, Day After Tomorrow. We're here now with Lisa Ling, special correspondent for The Oprah Winfrey Show and also for CNN. She recently reported for CNN's special called Planet in Peril, which will air on December 11th, and we're thrilled to have her with us today. Welcome, Lisa. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks, Orly. Great to be here.
Well, you traveled all over the world reporting for Planet in Peril, and some of the stories are absolutely amazing. Let's start by talking about one of the stories that you reported on in eastern Chad, where the last remaining pocket of elephants in Central Africa is at risk of being slaughtered. How did you end up covering that story?
Well, when we started learning about the numbers and how many elephants were being killed off, it was just one that was kind of a no-brainer. I mean, it's a region that has just been decimated in so many ways, and the elephant population in particular, because of the demand for ivory, has been particularly affected. And we went to only one of two places in the region where the African elephant still roams freely. And on the one hand, I have to say that it was one of the most amazing things to witness, to see these herds of elephants just roaming in the wild. But I also saw this beautiful creature killed just because of its tusks, and it's just happening so fast. And we went with the biologist Mike Fay from Wildlife Conservation Society, and his estimates of the reduction of elephants is just, it's very, very disturbing.
Now, how long were you in Africa reporting on that story, and what was it like to be on the ground and have these thundering herds going by?
Well, I was on the ground in Chad for about 6 or 7 days. it was kind of challenged conditions, so it started to sort of bleed together. We were living somewhat primitively, but it was just unbelievable to be amongst these enormous creatures. You know, I mean, I've been certainly exposed to elephants in different parks, but just to see these big herds. The tragic thing, though, was the herds that we experienced were probably some of the few left, and it really is a fight and a battle that's going on, because poachers have been surrounding the park waiting for the rainy season to end so they could come back in, but also Chad neighbors Sudan, and so the Janjaweed rebels allegedly are amassing at the border, and there are allegations that they could come, you know, through the park and just slaughter the last remaining elephants that exist.
And what can be done about the illegal ivory trade?
Well, the only thing really that can be done is to raise public awareness about it. China now, with its population over 1 billion people and rapidly growing middle class, is wanting to, you know, collect all of the status items that for so long Chinese have sort of revered. And so I think that once more Chinese and Americans, because the American market is enormous as well, start to become more educated about the rate of slaughter, I think that's the only way this can stop. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so proud that we tackled this story, because CNN has such wide reach. And I just don't think people, when they're shopping for products, really think about where things come from.
You also report on the problem of shark finning. So tell us a little bit more about that story.
Well, you know, as a Chinese American, shark fin soup has been part of my upbringing because it's considered to be a dish that you consume on very, very special occasions. It's quite an expensive dish. And again, it was one of those situations where I had no idea the impact that shark fin soup has on the shark population. Now, again, with China emerging and growing, the appetite for these kind of luxury items has increased a hundredfold, literally, with that population. And now shark fin soup in China is being sold in, you know, corner restaurants for $10 a bowl. And so what a lot of people don't realize is, to make shark fin soup, only the fins are required. And the price of fins these days has just started to climb. But the bodies of the sharks are worth nothing. So fishermen will go out into the waters and they'll pull up tons of sharks and they'll literally saw the fins off because the market is so high for the fins, and toss the bodies away. And it is having a hugely detrimental impact on the shark population throughout the world. And one of the things that surprised me most about sharks is, you know, sharks are considered to be the most vilified animals on Earth, you know, as a result of Jaws and pop culture. And anytime someone is killed by a shark, it makes headline news. But the reality is that worldwide, only about 10 people are killed a year by sharks, which really, when you think about all the reporting, is not that big a number. Well, about 70 million sharks are killed every year by humans. So the imbalance and the disparity there is, to me, pretty alarming. And it was something that I didn't realize before.
Now, most Americans have never seen a wild elephant or been close to a shark. So what do you say to someone who doesn't see why they should care so passionately about these issues?
Well, another reason or another thing that really surprised me about sharks is most sharks are actually very mild and non-threatening. It's only a couple species of sharks, the great white sharks, that have been known to attack human beings. And let's face it, at the end of the day, it's not the sharks who are venturing into human territory. It's humans who are venturing into the shark's habitat. And again, the number of people killed or injured by sharks pales in comparison to the number of sharks killed by a human. And so I would just encourage people, you know, if they're remotely curious about this, to explore these issues a little bit more deeply and not be influenced by media hype over sharks. I mean, you know, I think all of us, when you hear about sharks because of Jaws and other you know, pop culture elements, are terrified of sharks. But most sharks are actually very, very mild.
Well, it sounds like you have just maybe, I think, the best job in the world. I mean, you travel all over reporting on cutting-edge issues. You get to hang out with Oprah and Anderson Cooper. What have been some of the most exciting parts of your adventure along the way, specifically working on the Planet in Peril series?
Well, working on the Planet in Peril series for me has been so tremendously eye-opening. You know, it has been hugely challenging because we have had to, you know, venture out into territories where humans don't always inhabit. So on the you know, just endurance front, it's been hard. I mean, in Chad, for example, my team was just eaten by mosquitoes. My poor producer, Marianne, was literally, her body was just covered in welts from mosquitoes. So it was very challenging physically, but it just really opened my eyes to the destruction and the harm that, you know, man has been inflicting on the world's natural habitat. You know, I was exposed to populations of animals that have predated humans for thousands and thousands of years, yet in a very short period of time, man and his, you know, very heavy firepower is destroying entire populations, and as a result, really having a very severe impact on the world's, on these habitats' ecosystem. And I think that the more we learn about what's happening and the more we raise our level of consciousness, that's really the only way to ever stop it. So I hope that that's the kind of impact that Planet in Peril has, just really raising awareness.
Well, it's been great having you on the show today, and good luck to you in all your adventures and travels. You've been listening to Lisa Ling, special correspondent for CNN's Planet in Peril. And their Planet in Peril episode will air this Thursday, December 11th, from 9 to 11 Eastern, 8 to 10 Central, and 6 to 9 p.m. Pacific. We're joined now by Dr. Alan Green, the author of numerous books, including Raising Baby Green, and the founder of DrGreen.com. Dr. Green recently made headlines over the fact that he spent the past 3 years eating only organic foods, and he's here to talk with us about it today. Welcome.
Thank you, Orly. Great to be with you today.
It's great to have you on the show. There's so much we could talk about with you. I know you've written numerous books and you're an expert on child health. But what really interested us was the story that we saw about how you decided to go 3 years eating exclusively organic food. How did the idea come about to try that?
Well, I've been the chairman of the Scientific and Technical Advisory Council of a nonprofit called the Organic Center that does a lot of the research into the benefits about organic. So I've been immersed in the science. And then one day I was visiting a dairy farm and was standing out in talking to some of the farmers, and they remarked about how they saw an obvious difference in health when their cows transitioned from being conventional herds to organic herds. And they made this offhand remark that they didn't think it could happen to a person in the modern food system in the U.S. It'd be just too difficult to eat all organic. And that got me thinking. And I thought, I wonder if it would be possible to do that today and what it would be like. So I talked with my family and decided to set out on a 3-year journey, the amount of time it would take a cow to transition, a breeding stock to transition from conventional to organic.
And how did your family react to this?
They thought it was a crazy idea, but also thought it sounded pretty fun. And they know that I'm willing to try things to learn. And we agreed. I've got four kids, and I didn't want to be difficult on them at school or with their friends. And so we wanted to make it as low impact on them as possible. So we agreed I'd be the only one to do this, although our home pantry and fridge are all filled with organic food now.
So what were some of the biggest challenges of doing this?
Well, I learned pretty quickly that doing this at home was relatively easy. Once we just cleaned out the pantry and cleaned out the fridge, we had organic ingredients, and it wasn't too tough. You have control at home. What I hadn't anticipated is how little we have control over our food when we eat out. Somebody else is setting the agenda of what's available. So it takes planning ahead to eat organic when you're away from your own home. And it's really true for all of us. However we're going to eat when we're away, if you think ahead a little bit, you can eat in a much healthier way.
So tell us the truth. Did you ever cheat on the all-organic diet? 3 years is a long time.
3 years is a long time. And there were a number of mistakes that I made along the way, unintentionally, or at least semi-unintentionally. One of the first mistakes, I picked up a brand of yogurt that I thought was all organic and finished eating it before I noticed that particular one was all natural. And there are a few times that I asked it at restaurants, I said, is this organic? And they said, sure. And I was hungry and in a hurry and didn't really push to the end to make sure it was organic. It probably wasn't.
So because you're a doctor, let's talk a little bit about the health implications. How big of a difference does it actually make to go all organic? And, just as anecdotal evidence, did you feel different? Were you healthier?
Well, anecdotally, I did feel different. I noticed a huge surge in energy I needed. I woke up refreshed with less sleep. And as a pediatrician and one who travels a fair amount, I used to get sick a bunch of times every winter, every cold and flu season. And I've been much healthier overall. And scientifically, it's pretty clear-cut that when you choose organic produce, you'll reduce your pesticide exposure from food by about 97%. So you're making a big difference in exposure to toxins. In addition to that, you're not getting the genetically modified food, which there's emerging evidence could be related to an inflammatory state, an allergic state in people eating that.
Let's talk a little bit about costs. It's widely thought that organic foods are more expensive than conventional foods. How did you deal with that? Did you find that it was exorbitantly more expensive? Tell us about that.
Well, some things are a fair amount more expensive, especially higher up on the food chain that you go. The organic meats are a lot more expensive. You're getting a lot more value. The organic meats grown without the hormones that are used to conventional beef and can have up to five times the omega-3 fats and can have a healthier fatty acid profile overall. It's a great deal, but it does cost more. So one of the things that I suggest, if you want to keep your costs about the same, is to eat lower on the food chain. The more you switch to beans and legumes and vegetables and fruits away from the sort of top of the food chain items, you can get great food to fill your plate and cost about the same.
So now that the 3 years are up, do you think that you're going to continue with the all-organic diet or a mostly organic diet? What's the plan?
Well, I'm finding that I've gotten the hard work out of the way. I'm really enjoying it. And when I think about stopping, it feels difficult to let it go. It's been such a journey so far. On the other hand, it's not something I would recommend to everybody, and so I may switch to eat best available food just as a way that's more reproducible in the general population.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been great talking about your all-organic diet. Anything else you want to add for our listeners?
I just want people to be clear, this wasn't a hardship. Even though the planning was difficult, I got lots of delicious, great food along the way. Or food should be something that is a celebration, something you share with others, and it happens to be great for your health, too.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Green, who recently made headlines over the fact that he spent the past 3 years eating only organic foods. He also has a great website if you want to learn more about him at drgreen.com.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
This is DJ Bam from the Journey in a Trance Show. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
The performing arts are an important facet of life. There is no substitute for the relationship between audience and performer. Your contributions to the Henry Ford Community College Theater Program enable students and faculty to continue promoting HFCC's artistic standards. By becoming a member of the Friends of HFCC Theater, you are allowing the theater program to prosper through establishing a scholarship fund, improving costume and scene shop facilities, and enabling the continuation of musical theater productions. For more information on becoming a Friend of HFCC Theater, call 313-845-6478.
And hello, hello to you. This is Lynn, your host of No Boys Allowed, heard right here on WHFR 89.3. That's No Boys Allowed, where we explore the music of female artists who sing, who act, who play musical instruments, who speak quotable quotes. You'll even hear a recipe you might just like. Tune in every Saturday afternoon from 1 until 3 for No Boys Allowed with your host, Lynn, right here on WHFR, the station making waves. Where's that measuring cup?
Dealing with a mental illness.
Be there for your friend. Your support and understanding will give them a much greater chance of recovery. Mental illness. What a difference a friend makes. For more information on how to help a friend dealing with mental illness, go to whatadifference.org. This message is brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.